This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
The government and powerful companies will do whatever it takes to get ahead and remain powerful. You could argue that. That's how they got there in the first place. By being cutthroat, both figuratively and literally. While some people love to defend them, saying there's no way that people high up on the food chain and business and politics would ever do anything nefarious, others say there's no way they couldn't. Here are five tragic fates of whistleblowers and scientists. Number 5, David Sands and other Marconi employees. When it comes to the government, there's a lot of instances of questionable deaths that seem to blur the lines between accident and assassination. They're just too spot on in terms of timing and don't add up. When you have one death that falls under this type of category, it's harder to prove something sinister was behind it. But several, and the picture becomes clearer. One of those perplexing examples I'm talking about is that of 36-year-old David Sands, a defense scientist whose untimely death in 1987 sparked a series of conspiracy theories as to what really happened and why. Because Sands, along with several other defense scientists who met similarly mysterious fates, has people talking to this day about the highest branches of military and intelligence being involved in foul play. Sands, a married man with two young kids, was an esteemed scientist who spent most of his career working on sensitive defense projects for the British government. He was intelligent and hardworking. On a Monday morning in March of 1987, right after he completed a 3-year-long project working on a top-secret radar system, he apparently loaded his car up with multiple cans of gas and drove it at high speeds directly into a vacant roadside diner, causing a large explosion. The damage was so severe, the only way they could identify him was through his dental records. He left no note, had no prior indications of being in distress, so this whole situation was sketchy in its own right. But what made it all that more strange was that Sands was not the only defense scientist to die under unusual circumstances. In August of 1986, Vimal Jabahi, who worked for Marconi Underwater Systems and was just about to leave to go work for a higher-paying job, was found 100 miles away from his home in the town of Bristol, a place he had no connection to whatsoever, 250 feet beneath a bridge. 2 months later, Arshad Sharif drove out to a park in Bristol as well. He tied a long rope around his neck and the other end of the base of a tree. He then got in his Audi and drove it as fast as he could, which ended in decapitation. He was a computer scientist for Marconi Space and Defense Systems and was also a colleague of David Sands, as they both worked with satellites. David Skiles was an engineer with Marconi, and in February of 87, he was the victim of carbon monoxide poisoning inside his house. Also that same month, Victor Moore, a Marconi Space and Defense System employee, died of a drug overdose. The main vein of conspiracy theory suggests these deaths were not coincidences or isolated incidents, but part of a concerted effort to silence individuals who might have been ready to expose secrets or who had become liabilities for Marconi. Theories range from internal cleanups with intelligence services to eliminate potential whistleblowers to foreign espionage acts aimed at disrupting Western defense capabilities. While there isn't concrete evidence that these were murders, the peculiar circumstances surrounding each death, such as the absence of clear motives for the individuals to want to unlive themselves and the improbability of the accidents, provide fair grounds for speculation. The skeptics of these conspiracy theories argue that the high-stress environment of defense research could lead to mental health struggles, potentially explaining what happened. Official investigators into these deaths have largely supported these non-conspiratorial explanations, though they've often been criticized for their lack of depth or perceived attempts to avoid scrutiny. While official accounts lean towards tragedy, untainted by malice, it's understandable why what happened to these men continues to fuel debate and speculation. In the secretive, high-stakes world of defense research and intelligence, it seems very plausible that from time to time, in order to protect themselves, they'd be willing to do whatever it takes in order to keep a secret. Number 4. Dorothy Kilgallen, JFK whistleblower. Journalist Dorothy Kilgallen was found dead in her Manhattan townhouse on November 8th of 1965. She was found wearing a blue nightgown and sitting upright in her bed with a book next to her. The scene was initially pretty unremarkable, with the medical examiner saying the official cause of death was a combination of alcohol and barbiturate poisoning, so it was labeled as an accidental overdose. However, this explanation soon sparked controversy and skepticism for several reasons. First, friends and family contested the notion that Kilgallen was prone to such reckless behavior, noting her professional discipline and personal caution with medications. And secondly, discrepancies emerged regarding the scene of her death and the substances found in her system. Notably, the specific type of barbiturate that led to her overdose was not one that she had been prescribed, so where'd it come from? But on top of that, Kilgallen just so happened to be working on a sensitive and incriminating report on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy at the time of her death, leading some to speculate that her investigative work may have played a role in her untimely demise. Dorothy was deeply engrossed in investigating the assassination of JFK, which many think was a cover-up conspiracy, as I'm sure you're aware of. So, if Kilgallen did have some insider info, well, then she had to go. And she may have actually had that, as she claimed to have obtained information that would quote-unquote blow the lid off the Kennedy assassination, a statement that, following her death, fueled speculation about her sudden and accidental demise. She interviewed key figures related to the JFK case and allegedly came into possession of sensitive documents that have since never been found. Friends and colleagues of Kilgallen reported that she had received numerous threats in the months leading up to her death. The precise nature of these threats, though, and from whom they originated from, remains unclear. Adding to the controversy, though, of her whole situation, was Kilgallen's missing manuscript. She had spent years working on this book, which promised to reveal new details about the president's assassination. Following her death, though, the entire manuscript disappeared and has never been recovered. Some believe she was silenced by individuals with a vested interest in keeping the truth about the JFK assassination under wraps. Others suggest that her death was related to her reporting on organized crime or her involvement in high-profile legal cases. A more fringe theory says that her death was orchestrated by a jealous rival or someone from her personal life, although there's little evidence to support this. Whatever it was, though, the truth has never actually been revealed. Despite numerous calls for the case to be reopened over the years, official inquiries have maintained the stance that her death was accidental, leaving these theories unconfirmed but very fascinating. Number 3, Dr. David Kelly. Dr. David Kelly, a British weapons scientist and expert in biological warfare, was shot up into the public spotlight amid the contentious political debate over the UK's involvement in the Iraq War back in the early 2000s. His role in questioning the existence of WMDs in Iraq, which was a central justification for the war, placed him at the heart of a national controversy. His untimely and questionable death makes his story all that much more mysterious. And Dr. Kelly's expertise in the world of biological warfare led him to becoming a United Nations weapons inspector. And from there, he went on to play a crucial role in monitoring Iraq's compliance with disarmament obligations. At that time in the early 2000s, there were heated political debates over the legitimacy and necessity of military intervention in Iraq. And the UK government, led by Prime Minister Tony Blair, faced scrutiny over its use of intelligence to justify the war. On the other side of the fence, Dr. Kelly emerged as the one who cast doubt on the government's claims about Iraq's WMD capabilities. The report coming out of the BBC was explosive, citing an unnamed source, later revealed to be Kelly, that suggested the government had sexed up a dossier on Iraq's military capabilities to strengthen the case for war. Once exposed as the source, his name was leaked to the media, and this was a big deal. He was called to testify before the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Select Committee in July of 2003. During this televised session, Kelly appeared uncomfortable and under tremendous pressure as he faced a barrage of questions about his actions and motivations. And just a few days later, on July 17th, after sending an email to a friend suggesting he was determined to overcome the turmoil, Dr. Kelly left his home in Oxfordshire for a walk from which he would never return from. The following day, his body was discovered in the nearby woods. The cause of death was determined to be caused by several cuts to his wrist, coupled with an intake of caproxamol, a painkiller. The autopsy report, though, which was made public as part of the Hutton inquiry, left a lot of people wondering what the truth was exactly. According to the pathologist's findings, there were several cuts along the arm from a pruning knife he owned, and very deep ones at that. Ultimately, some forensic specialists and doctors have argued that the nature and extent of the wounds were unusual for someone choosing to unalive themselves. The amount of painkillers he took was significant, 29 pills in total, but not enough to be fatal, which again had people wondering why a presumably knowledgeable individual like Dr. Kelly, with simpler means to go out, would do this. There were also no fingerprints on the knife used, nor on the packages of painkillers. Yet, he wasn't wearing gloves. And why would his last piece of writing be to a friend talking about being ready to fight for his beliefs? And thus, alternative theories as to what really happened have popped up. Everything from an assassination by state actors to cover-ups by intelligence agencies. These theories are supported by a wide array of medical professionals, former colleagues, even some family members who dispute that Kelly would ever choose to give up his fight on his own accord. Ultimately, the spotlight on Dr. Kelly raised significant questions about the freedom of scientists and experts to speak out against governmental policies and the protection of whistleblowers. His treatment by both the government and the media sparked widespread concern, highlighting the personal risks faced by individuals who simply go against the grain. Number 2, Pinhead of Poison. Georgi Markov was born on March 1, 1929, in Sofia, Bulgaria. He started his career as a novelist and playwright in his home country, gaining notable success. However, Markov's relationship with the Bulgarian communist regime soured due to his critical views and outspoken nature. In 1969, seeking freedom of expression and fearing for his safety, he defected to the West, leaving behind his career, his family, and his homeland. In the West, Markov settled in London, where he continued his work as a writer. He also began broadcasting for the BBC, World Service, and Radio Free Europe platforms, through which he would reach Eastern Europe, and that included Bulgaria. His broadcasts were sharply critical of the communist regime in his home country, and he did not shy away from naming high-ranking officials, accusing them of corruption, incompetence, and oppression. On the morning of September 7th of 1978, Markov, like countless others, was on his way to work, unaware that this day would be his last. He was waiting for a bus near Waterloo Bridge in London on his way to the radio station. The weather was typical for that part of the world, prompting people around him to open up their umbrellas. It was during this mundane moment of day-to-day life that Markov felt a sharp sting on the back of his right thigh. And turning around, he saw a man picking up an umbrella from the ground. The stranger mumbled something that sounded like an apology before quickly jumping into a taxi. At work, Markov's thigh was very itchy all day, and he developed a small red pimple that was irritating. By the evening, his leg had swollen up, and then he developed a high fever. He was admitted to a hospital where he told doctors about the strange incident, suspecting it might be related to his symptoms. Despite medical efforts, Markov's condition rapidly deteriorated, and he died 3 days later on September 11, 1978. Because of what he said to doctors, a full autopsy was done, and it was then that they found in the tissue of the small red mark on his leg a tiny pellet with two holes drilled in it. Further analysis showed that the pellet contained a poison that there was no antidote for, ricine. The poison was inserted into the ball, then coated with a sugary substance that once heated up inside the skin would melt and release the ricine into Markov's bloodstream. It was an assassination like something out of a James Bond film. The weapon was no high-tech firearm or explosive, but an umbrella, modified to deliver a fatal dose of poison with a single prick. The umbrella contained a pneumatic mechanism, triggered by the assassin when he bumped into Markov, drive a tiny pellet no larger than a pinhead into his skin. This method was so subtle that initially even doctors and investigators were baffled by the symptoms Markov exhibited, suspecting a natural cause rather than foul play. Even though it turned into an international investigation that involved Scotland Yard, the FBI, and the KGB, while they were able to uncover the assassination umbrella, they never found the man responsible for using it. Though, it's widely believed the Bulgarian government, and perhaps even with the assistance of the KGB, were the ones responsible. Number 1. Anthrax Letters. In September and October of 2001, shortly after the 9/11 attacks, when the world was on high alert, a series of anthrax-laden letters were sent through the U.S. postal system. They targeted news media offices and U.S. senators. The first set of letters, postmarked September 18th, were sent to ABC, CBS, and NBC News, the New York Post, and the National Enquirer. A second batch, postmarked October 9th, targeted Democratic Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. They looked like any other ordinary piece of mail, only these letters contained a highly refined anthrax powder, resulting in 22 cases of anthrax infection, 5 of which were fatal. The letters not only caused direct harm, but also instigated widespread fear across the nation, as mail rooms and offices were shut down for decontamination. The investigation that followed, named Amerithrax, became one of the most complex and resource-intensive in FBI history. With their initial challenges in tracing the origins of the actual pieces of mail, the FBI then decided to focus on insiders, people who would have access to anthrax strains. Eventually, they began to focus in on a man named Dr. Bruce Ivins, who happened to be a leading anthrax researcher in the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute. The evidence on him included Ivan's access to the specific anthrax strain used in the attacks, his unusual work hours leading up to the attacks, and forensic analysis. However, the definitive proof was not 100%. Instead, for years, they had focused on a biological weapons expert named Stephen Hatfill. The FBI raided his home many times, but eventually Hatfill would sue them for defamation and win in 2008, which brought them back around to looking into Ivan's. Bruce then faced intense scrutiny as the prime suspect. He lost access to sensitive areas at his job because he couldn't be trusted. His colleagues treated him like a pariah, and Ivan's fell into a dark depression. On July 27th, 2008, as the investigation closed in and charges seemed imminent, Ivan's was found unconscious at his home. He was taken to the hospital, where he passed away due to an overdose of Tylenol mixed with codeine. His death abruptly ended the investigation, and just 8 days later, U.S. Attorney Jeff Taylor officially said that Ivan's was the sole culprit in the anthrax attacks, and that the case was closed. And this, some people found a little too convenient. The mystery surrounding Ivan's death would fuel various conspiracy theories, mainly ones that suggested Ivan's may have been a scapegoat for something bigger at hand. Many of those working in the same lab as him and field say that the strain of anthrax and quantity used would have taken at least a year to create, and that there's no way Ivan's could have done it in the labs without others noticing. That this creation must have come from the higher ups, maybe outside of the lab itself. In other words, the real powers to be, those secretive branches of government we don't even know about, may have been engineering the poison, either with or without the help of Ivan, but if he was involved, he was not alone in this creation and execution of mailing the envelopes. That the letters sent were assassinations for one reason or another, and or a means to continue to scare the public into believing they were under attack in order to help further justify things like the emergence of the TSA, for example. Ivan's being blamed was just a way to show that not only are terrorists coming from abroad like in the 9/11 attacks, but they are also here, and as such, we all need to fall in line and be further protected and controlled by those in charge. There were five tragic fates of whistleblowers and scientists. Hope you all enjoyed it. We really appreciate you coming by and checking out our podcast. If you want even more in-depth true crime stories, go check out our other podcast called Every Town, because every town has a dark side. For exclusive podcast episodes each and every week, go check out the insane stories we cover over on our Patreon. Links are in the description. Hope you have a good one. I'll see you guys in the next one.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.